And so we move this excitable science show to the planets and the stars. Do you remember those pictures of Pluto we were so excited about a few months ago? Yes, it was tremendous. But what happened next? All that data pouring back over nearly a year. Emma Ryan Weber is an associate professor at Swinburne in Melbourne.
Well, what happened is we started to receive pictures from Pluto, and it takes about 9 hours for this transmission to occur. And it's happening at about 125 bits a second. Then what we saw was amazing high-resolution images from the LORI camera that arrived here at NASA headquarters on Earth.
Well, one of the startling things is how it had the power to send all that stuff after, what was it, 10 years of travel?
Well, there's some batteries on board and it's been powered up to send them back. But because that transmission that's occurring is like any radio transmission, you can beam it to some extent, but basically those radio waves are being sent throughout our solar system in a sphere, and we're just capturing a tiny little bit of it down on Earth, and that's why the downlink takes so long to get to us.
It's quite stunning. And what has been found? Is it the distant, ordinary, boring rock that some people thought?
Absolutely not. The absolute reverse of that. And what we have found is a geologically active planet with an atmosphere. And this is absolutely remarkable. It is nothing like the dead rock that we see as the Earth's moon. It has glacial ice flows of nitrogen. It has ice mountains that are hard as rock. It has a pockmarked surface. It has cryogenic volcanoes. It is incredible.
Emma, you just said planet.
Ah, planet. Yes, my mistake.
No, are you allowed to?
My mistake. It is a dwarf planet. So when New Horizons left Earth in January 2006, Pluto was still classified as a planet. Later that year, the International Astronomical Union decided to declassify, to downgrade Pluto from a planet to a dwarf planet. And the reason for this was twofold. Firstly, the orbit that Pluto is on is elliptical. It's egg-shaped. It's not circular like the Earth and all the other classical planets going around the Sun.
But they're slightly elliptical, aren't they?
Oh, ever so slightly, but largely circular. Only a very small, tiny bit away from a circle. The other thing is that Pluto's orbit is tilted at 18 degrees to the flat plane. So everything else is sitting on the dinner plate. It's conforming to a circular orbit, and Pluto's is tilted. The other thing is that Pluto hasn't cleared its neighbourhood. So Earth and Mars and Venus, Mercury and all the gas giants, they've cleared their orbits. They've got a place in space that they can call their orbital zone that they dominate. Pluto is not the dominant object in its orbital zone. It's got Charon, who is nearly half its size. That's the largest moon around Pluto. The thing that motivated downgrading of Pluto was that we started to find, as we got better telescopes, more and more of Pluto-sized objects. Some were bigger, some were smaller, some were found in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, some were found in the Kuiper belt. So we got to the stage where either we had to start calling these new things planets, or we downgraded Pluto. And the simplest thing to do was to come up with a definition that we downgraded Pluto.
Fair enough. And of course, they keep talking about a ninth or tenth planet, as you said, in the Kuiper belt. But you said before, cryogenic volcano. Now, we think of a volcano on Earth as spewing up lava and, you know, molten rock. What comes out of one of Pluto's volcanoes?
New Horizons didn't see a volcano actually erupts, but we think we've got pretty good evidence for it. And so what we think has come out of one of these cryogenic volcanoes, and we see a depression in the top of a mountain that is a smooth depression, and it's got water ices. So it's a big slurry of water ice and nitrogen ice. And there might be a bit of methane and ammonia in there, which we can see from spectroscopic evidence and looking at the chemistry of the material that is on top of that mountain. And then we see flows that are down the outside in the same way that you would see geological features here on Earth of volcanoes.
And is this information still pouring down? Are we learning more and more things and seeing, for that matter, more and more pictures?
Absolutely. So downloading of the images will continue until the end of 2016. We've got most of the images now. And New Horizons is healthy. It's got a full battery. It is continuing on into the Kuiper Belt. And in January 2019, we're going to have a close encounter with a Kuiper Belt object. That will be perhaps one of the most primitive members of our solar system that we will get to encounter.
Emma, I know I'm prejudiced, but it seems to me that what with Juno and Jupiter and New Horizons and Pluto and the other examples, science is really kicking the goals. It's quite remarkable when you think of something travelling such a distance to the edge of the solar system and working just as promised and showing new results. It's incredible.
It is absolutely incredible that we can get a spacecraft out into our solar system and have it touch the edge of what we can currently get with our current technology. It is amazing.
Well, another amazing thing, of course, is your work, your normal work at Swinburne, looking at far distances that, is it true, may have shown us the first form of carbon?
That's correct, Robin. And so we have been looking at very distant objects, some of the most distant objects that we know about in the universe that are about 12 billion years old. And so the universe itself is 13.8 billion years old. So these objects have formed very early in the universe, following on from the Big Bang, and they're powered by supermassive black holes. And as gas falls onto these supermassive black holes, they shine very brightly. They're the brightest things that we can see at these distances. And we use them as a lighthouse as we look, and we take a spectrum of that lighthouse. So we break the light up into its component colours. And what we can see is little streaks of absorption lines in that rainbow of light. So you see a little dark gap where an atom has got in the way and it's absorbed that particular wavelength of light, that particular colour of light. And what I'm interested in is not the supermassive black hole itself. There are a lot of great people who study those. But what I'm interested in is clouds of gas along the line of sight to that supermassive black hole called a quasar. And what we see is signatures of elements such as carbon, magnesium, and silicon along the line of sight to that quasar. So we are seeing some of the very earliest carbon in the universe, 12 billion years old.
Well, of course, you showed some sort of surprise that it should be such newly formed carbon, if you like, in the age of the universe, because it's just over a billion years. Now, a billion years, 1,000 million years, seems a pretty long time to me for these elements to be cooked, no?
It's a long time and it's a short time. And so in the beginning, when there was the Big Bang only created hydrogen and helium. So if you know your periodic table, they're the simplest elements. From then on, you get oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and all the other elements. Those elements need to be created inside of stars. So when the very first stars formed, just out of hydrogen and helium, what happened is that in the cores of their stellar engines, there's a process known as stellar nuclear synthesis, and that synthesized those very first elements. And when those stars went supernova, the elements that were synthesized inside of their cores were then sprinkled out throughout the surrounding gas in between galaxies, and that is what we can see. So as it turns out, you and me and everywhere around us, it's actually made out of stardust.
Even the birds singing in the distance at this Uluru site where we are in the Northern Territory. Quite remarkable. But when you see this carbon, anything different about it, or is it the same stuff as we get round the corner?
it is the same stuff as we see around the corner. So that's quite remarkable. And what that is telling us is that processes inside of that supernova and those nuclear reactions that are going on in there are the same nuclear reactions that are going on inside the massive stars that are in our own Milky Way. And that's really reassuring because we use supernova for all sorts of things in astronomy. And most notably, our friend and colleague Brian Schmidt has used supernova as a distance measure. Now, we need supernova to be well behaved, and they need to be these standard candles. And if they were different 12 billion years ago, there would be more uncertainty surrounding our measurements of the acceleration of the universe and dark energy. So the fact that we see carbon of the same isotopes and in the same ratio as the ratio of carbon to silicon and carbon to oxygen is the same 12 billion years ago as it is here in the Milky Way is very reassuring for astrophysicists.
And so if you want to see what that cosmic carbon looks like, just stare at your hand. There it is. Professor Emma Ryan-Weber at Swinburne University in Melbourne.